Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Safe, and we are joined by Josh Krashauer, who is the politics editor at the National Journal. So, good afternoon, Josh, on a hell of a day.
A hell of a week, Charlie, in Washington. It feels like you're drinking out of a fire hose following all the latest political and impeachment developments here on Capitol Hill.
So we of course, have to start by looking at Twitter, because that's where the center of all of our political debates. A little more than an hour ago, you tweeted out, just spoke to a GOP source close to McConnell on the politics of impeachment. Quote, this is shaping up to be a very dark moment for the Trump White House. Okay, talk to me about that.
Very that quote caught my ear. This is someone who has skin in the game. Is someone who isn't just a fly-by-night source, but someone who understands the politics very, very closely. And look, I think Republicans acknowledge that it has to get things have to get really bad for the politics to just fall apart, and for enough Senate Republicans when we get to a trial, if we get to a trial, vote for impeachment. But surveying the news of the last 24 hours, there are Republicans that are getting closer to that point. Marco Rubio, who's been a pretty loyal Trump ally, even in the last couple of weeks, put out a tweet, a contradictory, and offered a reality check to Trump's rhetoric about the Middle East, about Syria. John Thune was quoted today with sort of very, very serious, sober thoughts about what's going on in with the testimony about Ukraine, and the fact that there clearly was now a quid pro quo where Trump himself was threatening crucial military funding to Ukraine in exchange for political dirt. This is not something that Republicans, they're trying to focus on process, they're trying to distract from the fundamental issues at hand. But when it comes to the Senate Republican caucus, even though they've been defending Trump, even though they've been, for the most part, allied with the president, they have a hard time defending what we're learning, and they're not going to be as slavishly pro-Trump as you see some of these Freedom Caucus Republicans and conservative House Republicans.
We want to get to them in a moment. So you quote your sources saying it's getting to be a harder choice for more people, whether that's enough for enough senators to take decisive action. Every single move has been in the wrong direction for this guy, referring to Trump. So when you say this is shaping up, or your sources saying this is shaping up to be a very dark moment, what are we talking about? What is the this? Was it the Taylor testimony? Is it the Taylor testimony with the drip, drip, drip? What is actually moving these guys to this mood? At least I'm going to say mood as opposed to moment.
Well, it's the reality that there's nothing left to spin. It's the reality that Republicans are basically left, if they want to defend the president, they have to defend his actions as being, as not being impeachable for basically threatening a foreign ally, one of our key bulwarks against Russia, to threatening them with crucial military aid if they don't dig up political dirt on Joe Biden. That's the reality, and that's a tough place for Republicans to be. Charlie, the big picture is the politics don't favor Republicans in coming out for impeachment or even criticizing the president. Even for senators that are in purple districts, the reality is still 80+% of Republicans defend the president, generally support his administration. So you're not winning politically. For any Republican member of Congress or senator, there's no benefit to breaking aggressively with them, certainly not calling for impeachment or removal. But we're getting to the point where things are getting bad enough substantively, if not politically, that it's a no-win situation. The Republicans that are, frankly, are number one, they may not be able to win regardless. If you're in a purple state, Trump is not popular enough for you to win unless his job approval numbers turn around and then the trend lines are ominous. But also, if you're in a no-win situation where if you stick with Trump, you're not going to win. If you break with Trump, you're not going to win. Some of these folks may end up standing up for their principles when all is said and done. And certainly you talked to enough of them privately, and the latest developments are just so striking. They're so damaging that, honestly, the Republicans will have a hard time defending the substance of what's going on.
Well, expecting Republicans to actually stand on principle seems like the triumph of hope over experience here, but something is changing. Let's talk about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Over the weekend, he had a very strong op-ed piece ripping the president's policy on Syria, which was notable, although their ability to compartmentalize can't be overestimated. And then you had that moment yesterday where Mitch McConnell is asked about Trump's claim that they had talked about the Ukraine conversation, that McConnell had told Trump that it was perfect. And McConnell said, we have not had any conversations on that subject. And he was, so was he lying? And McConnell's answer, you'll have to ask him. I don't know. Is that was sort of eyebrow raising at minimum?
Yeah, McConnell is a brilliant tactician. He cares about his holding the Republican majority, cares about the political standing of his caucus first and foremost. And he knows that sticking with Trump no matter what is not the smart political strategy. He wrote that op-ed on Syria, breaking aggressively with the president, but without mentioning the president's name. He mentioned Obama, I believe, several times, didn't mention Trump by name, but was clearly attacking his Middle East policy. And Trump, the thing that's happening, though, is that Trump isn't listening. He isn't listening to advice from McConnell. He's not listening to Republicans who are trying to give him some guidance. He gave a speech, about his decision on Syria, and it was incoherent. And it's hard to see Republicans getting behind it. So, you have to look at the big picture. Republicans want the political interest is to defend the president. Their own voters want support the president. So there's nothing to be gained by breaking with the president. But on issue after issue, the president is making it extremely hard for them to defend his policies. And this is coming at the worst possible time. So look, we're talking a couple months at least before we're facing a Senate trial if the House does vote articles of impeachment. I don't think anyone thought just there would be public support for an impeachment inquiry in the first place. That's where we were 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. No one thought that we were even close to being at that point. And all of a sudden, we learned enough new material that public opinion did shift. 2 weeks ago, I don't think anyone thought many Republicans would even dare speak out and be critical of the president's policies. And we've actually have seen either some prominent Republicans be somewhat critical, or even silence is a pretty damning reaction, because the natural instinct is to rally around the president, and you haven't seen a whole lot of at least Senate Republicans do so. So look, 2 months from now is a lifetime.
Yeah.
And the way this president is acting, the way the president is dismissing advice from the people who have his interests at heart, things are, as that source said, things are more likely, to get worse. Things aren't likely to get better the way things are heading.
Yeah, that's the thing is which things are going to get better for Trump, particularly with this particular trajectory. Okay, so you're talking to the Senate folks who are clearly rattled on this bad moment. But put this in context of what's going on over in the House side, where you have some of these Freedom Caucus types following Matt Gaetz. What 20, 30 House Republicans essentially storm the House Intelligence Committee hearing, where they were going to be talking with a Pentagon official about the Ukrainian military aid, and they're bringing their phones in and everything. What is this all about? And obviously, this has gotten a green light from House leadership. Steve Scalise is there, and they're basically having a demonstration to shut down this behind closed door hearing.
Yeah, this is the House Republican Freedom Caucus's Code Pink moment, trying to disrupt the hearing and I don't know how serious these are. I'm not familiar with all the regulations in terms of bringing a phone into the hearing room, but apparently there's some national security worries that these phones were brought in.
It's a secure facility, yeah.
It's a secure facility, of course. So, I don't know how this plays politically. I don't know how it plays well politically for the broader Republican Party. Maybe in these districts that these members represent, where Trump has 60-70+% support, but there are a lot of members that are in much more competitive states and districts, and there are also Senate Republicans with institutional concerns that are I would bet alarmed about what's going on the House side. These aren't the actions of a party confident in their arguments, confident in the defense of the president. It's the actions of a faction of the party that wants to just shut the dialogue down, shut the testimony down, and that can't be. I have a hard time seeing how that plays politically to the GOP's benefit.
Well, I mean, what it does, I mean, it, a couple of takeaways. I had a couple of takeaways. Number one, how heavy they are leaning on process right now, because as the evidence comes out, the whole no quid pro quo has been blown out of the water. So now they are focusing almost solely on process. And I guess the point would be, you know, why is this taking place in secret? And, you know, why is it behind closed doors? What's actually going on? And that is a talking point that might resonate. The other thing that, you know, it's funny because I was thinking about this yesterday, that given Trump's mentality, you know, what tactic might they use when you have the solemn vote on the impeachment of the President of the United States, one of the most serious constitutional responsibilities of the House? And one tactic that would seem completely consistent would be to turn it into a circus. Just, you know, one histrionic walkout, demonstration, shouting, just to make the whole thing look ridiculous so that voters will look at this and just be disgusted, turn away, and not get a sense of the gravity of the moment. Rob it of the seriousness as part of this ongoing campaign to delegitimize the whole process. And that's what you're seeing. So this clown show that you're seeing right now, this attempt to obstruct the investigation, seems to be part of what could be a larger strategy to just make the whole thing silly.
That certainly is the strategy. But when you look at the polls, and we've talked about this before, Charlie, this Ukraine stuff is resonating with the broader public in a way that nothing else has in the Trump presidency. So you have, I mean, nationally, you look at the national polls, you have, frankly, almost anyone who disapproves of Trump's performance in office, which is about 55% of the country, they support at least the impeachment inquiry. You have about 52%, depends on what poll you're looking at, but either a plurality or a narrow majority of Americans who support Trump's removal from office. So the notion that this is, I mean, you know, these kind of antics are going to be persuasive to a public that already is leaning against the president when it comes to impeachment. I don't think it's worked so far. I don't think it's gonna work now. And look, here's an example. One of the talking points that Republicans have been using the last couple of days is that even though all this damning testimony has emerged about what the U.S. government was doing, Giuliani was doing the shadow foreign policy, and these ambassadors were, you know, like Taylor was alarmed by this, that the Ukrainians didn't realize that there was anything being held up until much later.
Yeah.
Well, then the New York Times today, this afternoon, just came out with a new headline saying that Ukraine knew of the aid freeze by August, undermining Trump defense, and that, you know, basically undermining every talking point that Republicans have gone on television with to defend the president. So this is how it, I mean, you know, unless you think nothing matters, no facts matter, no adherence to truth matters. You know, the talking points that defenders of the president have been using have been undermined within 24 hours. Have been undermined by new reporting and by changing circumstances. So. You know, again, there is going to be that hardcore Trump base, 35%, I'd say, of the country. But that's not enough to, number one, get Trump elected. And I think if Trump's job approval dips below 40%, which it hasn't yet, but it's kind of stuck in that low 40% range, that's when you have Republicans, especially in the Senate, those who are up for reelection, are starting to get really, really antsy, really, really worried. And maybe it's not good politics for them to break with Trump, but sticking with Trump may not be good politics either.
Yeah, but of course, we've seen the ability of Trump world to move those goalposts. Jonathan Lass has a newsletter where he basically says, you know, here are the Trump defenses coming to a cable studio for you. You know, they move from no quid pro quo to, as you point out, you know, that Ukrainians didn't know about it. And they'll say, okay, they knew about it. It was, you know, it didn't actually happen. You know, and they'll just keep moving the goalposts, you know, from quid pro quo to quid pro quo. You know, but so what? He had it within his authority. Okay, even if he didn't have it in his authority, it's not an impeachable offense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, let's talk about these polls, because you've highlighted the fact that the impeachment is not quite as popular in the swing states as it is nationally. And we have a new poll out of my home state of Wisconsin, which would suggest that still impeachment support is underwater. So that's a distinction that's important, isn't it?
It absolutely is when it comes to understanding the politics of Congress. You know, the story of the Trump presidency is that the blue collar, you know, rural parts of the country have gotten more Republican, more conservative, more pro-Trump, and suburban America, even in areas of the country that used to be pretty Republican, have actually gotten much more Democratic, much more competitive. So, you know, this Wisconsin poll out today does show – I believe a narrow plurality opposing impeachment. And I cited in my column this week, even the Democrats' own House Campaign Committee polling showed only 49% of voters in the battleground districts support the inquiry, 48% oppose. So even the Democrats' own polling shows that to win the House, it's a different group of voters that you're targeting, and it's a much more skeptical. It's not, they still support it narrowly, but it's a much more skeptical group. So, the reality is that for Republicans, it's never going to be in their political interest. If you're Susan Collins, if you're Cory Gardner in the most purple of states, it's not going to be in your interest to break with the president. The flip side to that, though, is if Trump's numbers continue to dip just a few more points, and if you're Cory Gardner and you're down double digits to John Hickenlooper, do you go with your principles? Do you ultimately try to pull off the Band-Aid and maybe hope that Mike Pence can save you if he becomes president? Yeah, I don't think it's likely, but I do think that the people who think that there's 0% chance that the Senate would vote to impeach, I think are kind of, I think they're kind of reading too much into the day-to-day polling and not kind of gaming out how things can play out down the road.
Yeah, looking at this this Wisconsin poll, this is the Marquette University Law Poll, which is considered the best poll. Would show that that independents still don't think there's enough cause for impeachment. 35% say there is. 53% say there's not. Let's see here. New poll, 44% of Wisconsin voters say Trump should be impeached and removed. 51% say he should not be impeached and removed. And again, these are the swing states that will determine who gets to 270. And then the top line poll in the matchups, Joe Biden has 50%, Trump 44%, so he leads by 6. Elizabeth Warren leads by 1. That, by the way, tells me, I have to tell you, having watched these polls, that this poll seems to have more of a Republican sample than the previous poll, because there was a much wider lead for, if I recall, for Biden in the last poll. And sometimes these polls do jump around a little bit. So this seems like a slightly Trump-friendlier sample, but it does illustrate your point. Okay, so I want to talk about a couple of things, including another new poll, which seems to disrupt the narrative about what's going on the Democratic side, because, all of the stories have been the rise of Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden is dead in the water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a new poll, the CNN poll, showing that he's still ahead by a pretty substantial margin. And I want to talk about that, because that kind of disrupts the narrative. And then you have a very interesting piece that got an awful lot of attention, pointing out all the red flags for the Senate Republicans, which again goes back to this discussion about how the Senate impeachment is going to play out, that really it's starting to look like there's a very real chance that Mitch McConnell might lose his majority in 2020. So we'll talk about that. But first, a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security. Maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. All right, we're back with Josh Kroshauer from the National Journal Politics editor. So what do you make of this new CNN poll showing a pretty substantial, solid, durable lead for Joe Biden after all of this speculation about, Elizabeth Warren?
Well, it goes to show, and we've talked about this before on the show, Charlie, that Biden is winning by default with moderate Democratic voters, that Warren and Sanders too are so unappealing to anyone outside the far left, that Biden is essentially the default position for anyone who's not in that far left space. Now, Pete Buttigieg, and I wrote about him last week, he's trying, to his credit, his campaign realizes that there are a lot of votes there and in the middle of the Democratic Party that can be won. So he's repositioned himself to the center. Amy Klobuchar is, I think, trying to do that as well. But Biden is the brand. He's the moderate kind of establishment brand that has not done well at the debates, has kind of fumbled a little bit on the campaign trail, has been sort of the face of the Ukraine, the Democratic side that sees the top target of the president, and then Trump was trying to dig up dirt against Hunter Biden. That was how this all got started. But Biden is holding his own. And look, it depends on what poll you look at, whether it's better news for Biden or not quite as good news for Biden. But until there's someone who really breaks into Biden's support with both moderate voters and African-American voters, he's still a formidable candidate. And I think people kind of don't realize how potentially frankly unappealing Warren is as a general election candidate.
Wow.
And how she and again, like I said earlier, Charlie, people look at polls in the moment, but they don't kind of anticipate outcomes. They kind of look in the past instead of anticipate the future. Warren has not been hit by, until the debate last Tuesday, she had not been hit by other Democrats, and she was certainly not being hit by President Trump like she had been earlier in the campaign. So she's been sort of coasting along, just saying Medicare for all and kind of all in her talking points. And then once she came into a debate and some Democrats dared challenge her on the math and her honesty and her candor, her numbers have been dipping. And not just that one CNN poll, but in a couple other polls that have been out since the debate, her support has either stagnated or slipped a little bit. So, Warren is like one of those stocks, like it's like the WeWork stock, where you look at the valuations, you looks good in the moment, she's got the momentum, but then you realize she hasn't really taken any enemy fire. She hasn't really been scrutinized the way most candidates like Biden have been scrutinized. And my own analysis is that she's going to have some trouble even within the Democratic electorate once the math of and the feasibility of that Medicare for All plan gets scrutinized. But I think she is one of the few Democratic candidates that might actually lose a general election to President Trump, given how polarizing and how out of the mainstream some of her big positions are.
Well, that I agree with you about that. And a couple of stories that I think suggest that some of the big Democratic donors are starting to get nervous about that as well. But on this CNN poll, for people who haven't seen it, Biden is at 34% of Democratic and Democratic-leaning registered voters, which is his best showing in CNN polling since he announced. Warren is at 19%. Bernie Sanders is at 16%. Everybody else is down there. So tell me, though, about this Pete Buttigieg. Pete Buttigieg going after Biden, because, of course, that was a little cognitive dissonance there, because it sort of looked like he was going after Elizabeth Warren. So what is Pete Buttigieg up to in regard to Biden's campaign?
Well, I think he realizes that the way he wins the nomination, Pete Buttigieg's biggest challenge is African-American voters. He needs to win Iowa. He needs to win Iowa or come into close, second place to really propel his campaign. And then even if he does that, he's still going to have a dogfight to win enough delegates, because he's going to struggle in the South. He's going to struggle in certain parts of the country. But, so Buttigieg knows that the way to win, the way to build a niche candidacy is challenge Biden from the middle, like try to make himself look like a more electable, younger, more vibrant, articulate alternative to Joe Biden. And I think he did a very good job of that in the debate. I thought his answer on Syria, for instance, was excellent. It's something that I think could actually unite a lot of Republicans and Democrats in terms of their reaction to it. I want to take one step back, though, and just articulate that national polls can be misleading, because everything is going to start off in Iowa. And there was a new poll by Suffolk University, USA Today, that showed Warren slipping in Iowa down to 17%, Biden slipping in Iowa down to 18%, but Pete Buttigieg gaining, and he's at 13% with a huge wide open scrum in the middle of the contest. This race is hardly developed, and Iowa is going to be a huge momentum builder. I think it's anyone's game in Iowa. And the Buttigieg play is that he can kind of consolidate enough white moderate voters to support him in Iowa do really well in the caucus and then use that as momentum into New Hampshire and then into a lot of other similarly minded Super Tuesday states.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real horse race. 18, 17, 13, that's almost within the margin of error. So Elizabeth Warren has to win Iowa, doesn't she? I mean, she has to win at least Iowa and either Iowa and New Hampshire, or do you think she has to win both of them?
Yeah, I don't think she has to win both of them. I think she needs to perform well in Iowa because the expectations are very high for her, and I don't know if if she fails in the two early states, it's hard for her to gain momentum in South Carolina and even Nevada and the caucuses there. So, look, there's so many formulations. This is a much more wide-open Democratic nomination, as I think a lot of candidates are appreciating at this point. So, Amy Klobuchar, who's, still polling like 3%, she's still far back from the front runner. You could see a pathway for her to do well in Iowa. She's well-liked by a lot of Democrats. If she starts spending money and she has another good debate moment, you can see that I could easily see her propelling into the top tier in Iowa. So, I mean, I think what we're seeing in the last couple of weeks is buyer's remorse on Warren. I think there are a lot of people that were kind of like, well, she's going to be the nominee. Why don't we rally behind, if you're not for Biden, why don't we rally behind that flag? And now people are realizing that there's some serious electability issues there, and there's frankly, some serious issues of being honest about the price of her Medicare for All single-payer plan.
Yeah, it is not hard for someone like me to imagine what the Republican campaign would look like against her, what $100 million of ads in these swing states would do to her image on that issue of trustworthiness, because what Trump does, but also on the positions she's taken on issues like health care, foreign policy, calling for the immediate ban of fracking. I'm guessing that's not a big winner in places like Pennsylvania. So let's talk about your piece about the red flags for Senate Republicans, because this has really been sort of off the table until now, because the assumption has been that the map kind of favors, that it looked like it was going to be a really, really, really tough hill for Democrats to climb to win the Senate, particularly because they're almost certainly going to lose the Senate seat in Alabama. So what are these red flags that had probably got Mitch McConnell staying up at night looking at the numbers?
So the big picture is fundraising. We had fundraising reports come out in the last, the last couple weeks, and there were four senators, including three in swing states, that actually got outraised by little-known or lesser-known Democratic challengers. You had Tom Tillis, who a lot of people thought was in pretty good shape in North Carolina, just raise a little over $1 million, and watch his Republican primary challenger loan himself the exact same amount of money that Tillis raised. You have polling data from Morning Consult that shows every one of those five Republican senators in these competitive races have underwater job approval ratings. I think people realized Cory Gardner was going to be in a tough race in Colorado. People realized Arizona is going to be tough with Martha McSally. But I think they thought Tillis was going to be okay. And certainly they thought Susan Collins is bulletproof. And Joni Ernst is one of the more likable senators in Iowa. What happened in the last couple of weeks with these fundraising numbers and these polls is that the Iowa and Maine firewall has sort of looked a lot weaker than it did a month or two ago. Collins was outraised by her opponent. Her numbers have slipped a little bit in Maine. Ernst is facing a big Trump problem, frankly, in Iowa, because the tariffs are really hitting the farmers significantly. And there was a Des Moines Register poll that came out recently that showed 28% of Republicans think that Trump's tariffs are hurting farmers in the state. These are Republicans. This is the Trump base. Iowa's a swing state. It has a lot of voters who went for Obama and then switched to Trump in last election. So Ernst, I think, understands that she's not as secure. She's not in as secure a position as she was. So when you look at the bigger math, I mean, here's the big picture. I mean, Democrats basically need to win four seats, pick up four seats to get the majority. I'm assuming Alabama goes back to the Republicans. And I'm assuming Trump doesn't win a second term. That is looking much more realistic. You have Arizona looking like a very winnable race for Democrats. Colorado looking very winnable. Both those Republican senators are losing in head-to-head matchups. North Carolina, Tillis is facing a two-front war with the left and the right. That's looking very winnable. So then it comes down to you got three seats, you got one more you need to win, and it might come down to either Ernst or Collins. It's not easy to do for Democrats, but it's a lot more realistic than I think anyone thought a few months ago.
So, okay, so how does this play into what we were talking about earlier, the debate about impeachment? I can't see any of these vulnerable Republicans deciding to vote against Trump, because that certainly doesn't, I don't see how that enhances their chance for reelection. Am I wrong about that? I mean, you know, Cory Gardner, if he votes to, I mean, he's going to lose either way, probably, right? I mean, he votes for the removal. He's not going to pick up any Democratic votes, and the Republicans are going to be ticked off at him, so he's dead, right? I mean, does that save Susan Collins?
No, like we've been saying, Charlie, any Republican who breaks with Trump, especially if it happens in isolation, is going to be like, you know, Mark Sanford or Jeff Flake or any of the other Republicans. Now, if they all jump together, maybe you would see a different story. But, what does that mean for impeachment? I think the big picture is that if the Senate battlegrounds don't, you know, look troubling, if these Republicans don't pick up steam in their campaigns, you know, Mitch McConnell could be looking at the reality with Trump as president of losing the White House, losing the House, and losing the Senate, even with the status quo. So there may be at some point a calculation that, look, I don't know how, you know, removing a president of your own party would help you politically, but boy, we also have very short memories in politics. And Mike Pence, if Democrats nominate Elizabeth Warren and Republicans have Mike Pence on the ballot, is it possible that Republicans actually might be in better shape than having Trump on the ballot in November? I'm not sure what the answer is to that question, but if things look so gloomy, if things look like they're all falling away from Republicans, including the Senate, that makes it more likely that McConnell may be a little more of a risk taker when it comes to dealing with Trump.
I'm still very skeptical on that, but that's where I wanted to go next, is Mike Pence. Is there any, have we got to that moment yet where people are asking the question you just asked? Okay, so what is the Republican, social conservative, Trumpian argument against Mike Pence? I mean, it's at some point, if the binary choice is, look, if the binary choice is Trump versus Elizabeth Warren, we know where Republicans are going to go. But what if they start thinking, if the idea starts to percolate that the binary choice is really Trump versus Pence? We're not there yet, right? But
we're not there. And I would warn that, you know, removing number one, knowing Trump, and number two, removing a president of your own party would threaten to divide the Republican Party in two and cause some second order effects that could be truly, you know, devastating in the short term for the Republicans. But the alternative view, though, is if we're so polarized as a country, you know, if Warren and you know, we hear the reason people support Trump is because the progressive left is such a threat to GOP and conservative interests. Well, like, if that's the case, if that truly is the case, then why wouldn't, you know, Republicans rally around Pence if Trump was removed? Like, why would they want to have, if that logic holds, then you actually could say that impeaching Trump and actually having a more, you know, traditional, stable Republican president might actually help GOP chances. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot more risk than to that, you know, an impeachment scenario. But we are polarized, and if Warren truly is the cause that unites Republicans, and if she's the nominee on the Democratic side, then maybe Pence would be a big improvement for Trump.
This is also one of the strange moments as I'm watching the various defenses come. This, and I know that you tweeted this out, the court hearing at which a judge asked the Trump lawyers, so are you saying that if the president shot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, that no one has the legal right to investigate it? And at least according to this account, the Trump lawyers said, yeah, that's right. You could shoot somebody. If the president shoots somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, he is immune from both prosecution and investigation. That's kind of one of those, wow, really, is that the hill you're going to die on?
Yeah. Look, you can't make some of this stuff
I know,
up. I mean, you really can't. And that, I think that when some of the stuff becomes so difficult for Republicans to defend, you know, the general MO for McConnell, and it was a good one for his Republican senators, is you just don't engage. You just avoid the, you know, you avoid answering the question. You just say, you know, deal with the serious issues. You do the pull the Paul Ryan. You kind of dodge and weave, and then you focus on what you want to do and who you want to talk about. That's not sustainable anymore. I mean, that is not. And with the impeachment hearings and the evidence being crystal clear, that's not a sustainable option. So when you hear stories like this of you know people, the Trump attorneys trying to kind of say the indefensible, you know, you can understand why they're in such a political vice. You can understand why it's become so politically difficult.
So watching the Senate, we have Mitt Romney out there, and you know, the getting from 1 to 2 is a huge leap for Senate Republicans. And I was asked this the other day, and I think I choked on it because I didn't have a good answer for it. So who do you think is going to be number 2? Who are you really watching right now to see which way they go, which will tell you? Because the reason I'm asking this is I think if you get to 2 and 3, you might get to 10. That in the end, it's going to be either a critical mass or it's just going to be Romney alone. So that number 2, number 3 is crucial about whether the dam breaks. Do you agree with that analysis, by the way?
I absolutely. Power numbers, right? I mean, once you get to 5, you get to 20. I mean, it's easy to see a path to 20 once you get to 5 or 6. So that's definitely the case. And let me throw a few names out there. I think it's actually going to be people that are not up for election in 2020. I think, you know, aside from maybe Ben Sasse, who seems to be, you know, he's an interesting person to watch, but I just have a hard time seeing anyone with skin in the game trying to, you know, I think they're going to be the last to fall if it gets to 20. The three names I would watch are Richard Burr, the likely retiring head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who's not been a loyalist of Trump, has been someone who's more of an institutionalist. I would put Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who's always been a renegade and a maverick, and she has been critical of the president. I put Pat Toomey on that list too, and I think actually it might be interesting to look at these senators who are up for re-election in 2022, who are up in the next cycle, because the politics for the 2020 candidates are not good when it comes to breaking with the president, but the politics might be worse for the 22 candidate, the candidates up 2 years later, to actually support the president and then find out he, you know, committed these crimes or committed these misdeeds and then having to defend it after Trump leaves office.
Yeah, I mean, going on this, you could imagine a scenario which would be very dramatic if it was Romney joined by Murkowski, really a bombshell if Burr goes, and then someone like a Lamar Alexander, one of the retiring, you know, old, you know, barons of the Senate. Then you have the sense that there would be real momentum.
Well, and look, there are other names you could think of that I wouldn't, in isolation, I wouldn't see them bolting from the president. But in terms of any kind of coordinated movement, like John Thune has been a very, very wary defender of, and he's from South Dakota. So, you know, if you just judge this on the current politics, you're not going to get even close to 20. But you never know. I mean, the game theory, when you kind of play this out, you can also see a scenario where things get so bad that and that, you know, perhaps McConnell would have trouble seeing how to hold the majority the way things are going. That would be the circumstance in which you might see, things falling apart.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, events as well, given the way things are going, you know, what other shoes are going to drop? What other guns are going to smoke? And I could see a number of them. I mean, by the way, my advice to any Republican would be, you might want to keep your powder dry right now, but you don't know what he's going to do tomorrow. You may offer a defense today that's going to be blown up. As you pointed out, this whole Ukraine didn't know about it was a big talking point for a lot of folks. I saw a video montage of all the Republicans who went out and said, well, there was obviously no quid pro quo. And virtually any defense you can offer might be inoperative after the next week. Plus, you don't know whether you're going to have other transcripts of other phone calls. Are we going to see the transcript of the conversation with Erdogan? Are we going to see transcripts of calls with, you know, President Xi of China? Are other people in the Pentagon and the State Department going to come forward with other pieces of information? Is the president himself going to do something impulsively that they just cannot defend? I mean, I see that Nancy Pelosi and the Secretary of Defense are in Afghanistan assuring them, don't worry, we are not going to bail on you. Based on what? How do you reassure
Charlie, to put it all in context, is that the general Republican thinking is that as long as Trump and Republicans were pulling on the same boat, we're kind of in this together, that they could temper Trump's worst impulses and he would gain politically. He would actually gain by having a larger coalition with both establishment and populist Republicans. And it was working. Frankly, even with all the controversies, with all the chaos, that in the big picture, Republicans got tax cuts, they got judges, they got they even got a foreign policy that, for all the quirkiness of what Trump was doing, you know, generally he listened to the military, he listened to the Jim Mattis, he listened to the national security experts, and Republicans were fine with it. It's only in the last few months, really, when we've seen a lot of retirements, we've seen a lot of, you know, the so-called adults in the room have left, there have been a lot of acting, less influential members in key positions, that the chaos of before has truly just gotten into a whole new level of dysfunction. And that's what's worrying, I mean, Republicans in their private moments, that, you know, our foreign policy, just in the with one phone call to Erdogan, our entire Middle East strategy fell apart, and you know, thousands of people may be dead, our Kurdish allies and ISIS fighters may, you know, were released from prison as a result of the impulsiveness, as a result of a lack of checks internally in this administration. That is what's keeping Republicans up at night, because, you know, when you can just say, well, it's a little bit of chaos, but we've got Mattis, we've got McMaster, we've got people, Bolton, even, you know, people that know what they're doing, we can sleep well at night. We know we'd be much better as a united party going into the 2020 election. But when Trump is acting against their own principles, I mean, when he's withdrawing troops, when he's, you know, actually acting on his rhetoric that he wasn't doing in a way, you know, that he wasn't doing as much beforehand, you know, all of a sudden the calculus changes. And while the politics may not be changing, may not have dramatically changed among Republicans in the moment, you definitely can see, like, look at Lindsey Graham, for example. You know, this is a loyalist, someone who's basically operated under the principle that, look, I need to get reelected. I can get more done in terms of my foreign policy worldview by playing ball with Trump than attacking him. And he's been a loyal soldier. But even Graham had enough this last week, and given what's happened in Syria, and even he has offered some awfully critical responses to the president's behavior. You know, that's a sign. That's a bellwether to me. That's a sign that things are not well.
But never overestimate his capacity for accepting humiliation. So there's always that as well.
Yeah, but you know, I think Graham is an interesting character, because he's given interviews where he's pretty transparent about his MO, which is that, you know, he cares about foreign, he cares about the Middle East, he cares about, you know, making sure we have aggressive posture, and we keep our troops and stop ISIS from reemerging in Syria. And, you know, he's willing to do anything to, you know, and like you said, maybe debase himself a little bit in order to get that done. And he's won out of these internal battles with Trump, these internal battles with the Rand Paul wing of the party. But once Trump kind of didn't even consult him in terms, and that changed even Graham's calculus. And that's, you could certainly see Graham reacting in a way that you hadn't seen him do so before.
Josh Kroshauer, thank you so much for joining us again on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the podcast today. The episode was brought to you by Simply Safe. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.